Hello and welcome to the Dad Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Worsham. With me, as per usual, is the fantastic Dr. Jay Soute, our stand-up pediatrician, but also joining us today, former med student of Dr. Jay, and that is Dr. Greg, I'm going to butcher his last name, Canapari. Canapari. I'm sticking with Canapari. That's what I'm going with. Did I get it right?
It works for me.
It works?
You crushed it.
I did? Was I right, or are you just being nice?
Yeah. No. Canapari is right. I will say I often get confused with Greg Canapari. I am Craig Canapari.
Oh, okay, good. That's good. All right, good. That's real close. It'd be really embarrassing if we called the wrong guy.
And he knows nothing about sleep, so.
Absolutely.
If my parents had named my brother Greg, that would have been pretty hilarious.
Oh, that would be horrible. That would be. What is your brother's actual name, out of curiosity?
He's Matt or Matthew.
Okay, good.
He's an accountant, so he's got nothing to do with sleep.
I have Jack and Jacob, which I think are the Craig and Greg of the J names, if I could be so stupid as a parent. But anyway, point is, the reason we have Dr. Can I call you Dr. Craig? Is that okay?
Yeah, please.
So the reason we have Dr. Craig here is Dr. J and I were talking about the next topic, and I had done some recent poking around into sleep habits of kids because my wife was at a Burbank Leadership, which is kind of like a group of networking. It's like a class where, you know, leaders in business network here in the city of Burbank in Southern California. And they had a member, they have like experts in certain fields and stuff come in. They work really closely with the Family Service Center for the city. And they had a member of the school board come in. And there's a lot of talk. I'm sure everybody's hearing it all over, at least in the States, about moving back the start time of school. And this guy came on and said that it is impossible for a teenager to fall asleep before 11 o'clock because of melatonin levels and just the natural cycles of their hormones, whatever you want to call it. We'll get Dr. Craig to kind of get more into that. In fact, let's start with that. I wanted to start with the baby stuff, but let's do that the next segment. Since we're here now, let's start off. Is there validity in what he's saying? Is it impossible for a teenager to go to bed before 11? And if so, why?
Well, sure. Let me back up a little bit,
yeah.
Justin, because I think it's important to understand the problem we have with sleep in teenagers. And the fact is, there's a study by the CDC about 4 years ago, and it said that about 10% of teens were getting adequate sleep on a school night.
Wow.
Which is pretty crazy when you think about it. Sleep is a natural biological function. It's something you have to do. It's like eating or breathing. And most people wouldn't tolerate their kids going to a school, say, where there was lead in the water or the food was contaminated or the air quality was really poor. But we've structured high school in such a way that it's leading to most teenagers being sleep deprived. And I'm going to I don't want to lecture you guys here. But a lot of this has to do with high school start times. There are some other reasons why teenagers are sleep deprived as well. But the biggest structural problem is when they have to get to school in the morning.
And why is that? Why is it that the start times are what they are? And can we change them?
It wasn't that long ago, probably around the time of our grandparents, when schools would start between 8 and 9 in the morning. You'd have your one-room schoolhouse. Everybody would go to school at the same time. It would be a pretty small school. And then in the 50s and 60s, they started, you know, building out the suburbs and having larger school districts. And all of a sudden, the school boards would have a certain budget where they would have to bus kids to school instead of having them just walk to this single one-room schoolhouse. So then they decided instead of busing everybody at the same time, they would stagger the times that school started. And teenagers were put first because the idea was they could actually get out earlier and go to work. This is more of an issue in suburbs, in many urban districts, and even suburbs where you can walk everywhere. Like we lived outside of Boston in a town called Arlington. All the schools started at 8 because everybody walked to school. So this is really a function of suburbs and districts getting spread out. And the it's funny because if people argue about changing bell times for high schools, they say, well, you know, this is the way that it was for me, and it you know, it worked great, and you know, we could argue whether that was the case, that's the case or not. But the fact is, that's not the way it's always been. And in fact, if you look at Dallas, Texas, all the high schools start at 9 a.m. And it's not because Dallas is this hotbed of you know, liberal and progressive policies. They just never changed the start times back in the 50s.
Wow. And that's so, and it's funny to me because especially now where you kids that have part-time jobs is like none, like it, so it's not even necessary. And yet we're still hanging on to it and clinging to it in some way, shape or form. What do you say to someone? Cause I've talked to this with, about this with other people. What do you say to the idea that it's like, come on, like just suck it up. Like what kind of what you're saying is that, well, it's what we always did. And to me, it sounds like a thing where it's, well, why not make it more beneficial if you can?
Well, I think that, you know, it really comes down to biology, like you were talking about before. So, you know, everybody who has children, you know, when they're little, they're going to go to bed relatively early. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that they actually just accumulate what we call sleep drive. Like the longer you're awake, the more tired you are. This is super easy to understand, right? Everybody knows if you stay up later, you get up early, then you're more tired the next day because as you go through daytime, you're accumulating more of this neurotransmitter called adenosine, and you get sleepier. And smaller kids accumulate this at a faster rate than older kids and adults. So that's why they tend to need more sleep. And that's one part of the sleep-wake system. It's called process S, if you want to get into the technical part of it. The other part of it is the circadian or body clock part of this. And the body clock, most people think about it in terms of the timing of sleep, but really it comes down to the timing of wake. So your body clock signal is peaking in the late afternoon and the early evening to keep you awake because at that time of the day, you have more sleep drive, you've been awake for longer. So that wakefulness signal is coming in and keeping you awake. In little kids, usually they're pretty tired around between 7:30 and 8:30, and that wakefulness drive trails off. And then they go to sleep, and then they get up generally pretty early in the morning. When you head into puberty, that wakefulness drive shifts later between 2 and 3 hours. So you take kids that were naturally and easily falling asleep at 8 o'clock, and all of a sudden their bodies want them to fall asleep at like 9, 10, 11, and in some cases much later than that. But your average teenager biologically would be well suited to a sleep period, you know, from 11 to 9 or even 11 to 8, 12 to 9 would be very comfortable for them. And sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You are far more interesting than me. Go.
Oh no. What happens is when you have these really early start times is you have kids that are, and again, the stereotype is the teenagers are lazy and that they're, you know, just on their cell phones all the time. And they're partially to blame, right? Like, you know, we need kids to be really responsible about how they manage their access to this technology. But the research showing that teenagers naturally fall asleep between 11 and 12 at night is actually from the early 90s. That's before we had online wow. gaming or, you know, cell phones or any of this stuff. I mean, you know, I graduated from high school in 1991. You know, the height of technology was a cordless phone you could take to your room and talk without to your girlfriend or boyfriend without your parents overhearing.
Well, there were jokes, you know, in the 80s on sitcoms about how teenagers would sleep all day. So it isn't technology that is making this an issue. And what's funny is that what we're talking a lot about the time that they go to bed, when they're ready to go to bed. But going back to what you said, if it is about the wake time, then the reason they're going to bed a little bit later is because they need to wake up a little bit later, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, let me give you an example of my town. I live in a town called Guilford, Connecticut. Our start time is at 7:20 in the morning. So, and our town is the size and shape of Manhattan. So it's skinny, and it's about 13 miles long. And I remember when I moved to town, I was going out for a run in the morning at like 6:20 in the morning. Again, that's something that has not happened before or since. But I see a kid standing at the end of his driveway, and I'm like, that's weird. What the hell is that kid doing out here? And then I see another kid walk down the driveway, and then saw the school bus come, and then I know because of my job, I'm like, I can't believe this is so early. Because not only that, those kids are getting on the bus around 6:20 in the morning, and then many of them are dropped off at the high school at 7, even before the bell time, so they can get out for the middle school run. Our town is especially excessive because both of the fact that they've got to be on the bus for a long time because of the size of the town. And our start times are probably, they're definitely earlier than 90% of districts in the U.S. So 90% of districts will start after 7:30, and the average start time for public high schools in the U.S. is around 8:04 a.m.
Wow. At a time where I feel like we are more focused on children than ever in history, how long do you think it's going to take to turn this oil tanker around as far as, I mean, this is ingrained in our society on a nationwide level, and I'm sure on a lot of levels, even our listeners that are outside of the United States, on a global level, how hard is it to turn the tide of this bureaucratic school system?
Well, let me tell you, it's really hard. I'm actually involved with a national organization called Start School Later. And if people are interested, they can check them out at startschoollater.net. We had our first ever start time conference in D.C. And actually a legislator came to come from California, and they were looking to address this as a state issue. In the United States, you know, municipalities are each their own little fiefdom. So there's local taxes paid for the schools, and the local school board determines when school starts and when it ends. And there are lots of arguments against changing start times. It is certainly, and they come down to a couple of major ones. One is the expense. Like, you know, if you want to say change your busing regime, it can cost money, though sometimes districts will save money if they actually make their busing more efficient. The other tends to be around extracurriculars. One thing that has changed quite a bit since I was in high school is the amount and intensity of extracurricular activities that kids are expected to do. I mean, high school athletes are almost like little professionals now, and they get out of school, they have activity after activity booked, and many of them will leave the house in the morning at 6:30 or 7 and not get home until 9 or 10 o'clock at night, at which time they have to start their homework. It's just nuts. Yeah. What we've expected teenagers to do in our society right now. I mean, I'd be curious to see what Jay's perspective on this, because he's been doing this for a while.
Too, is the hockey players get up at 4:15 in the morning because they can get ice time before school. So like our town hockey team is on the ice from like 4:45 till 6:30, and then they go right to school from there. And then if they have a game in the evening, you know, they're really shortchanging themselves on sleep. I wonder if anyone's ever looked at morning hockey practice and how that affects kids, because that's even a couple hours earlier than the 6:30 we were talking about.
Well, then it becomes a thing about like return on investment, right? Because so this is what I'd like to ask both of you. We'll start.
We got
with
a
you.
Shitty hockey team.
We'll start with you, Dr. J. Is that in your professional opinion, and even feel free to differentiate your personal opinion if you think they are different, but is it worth pulling my kids out of high school or any kind of athletics just because their sleep cycles and circadian rhythms could be interrupted? Or should I only look at doing this if they seem to be struggling a lot in school? Or is there a point where I pull the ripcord and yank them out? Or is it just the cost of doing business?
Well, they have to do more than sleep and go to school. So there, you have to have a balance. I had a, you know, from the day I turned 16, I had a part-time job. And there were nights I'd have to work, you know, be at school all day, go to work until 11, try to get my homework done, be in bed by midnight, and be up at 6 the next morning and, you know, rinse, lather, repeat. And some people can do it. Other people, you know, because of their makeup, require more sleep. I tell kids, you know, that they should be shooting for, you know, 8 to 9 hours of sleep a night. And I would say 80% aren't in the high school age group, aren't coming close to that.
How about you, Dr. Craig?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, first of all, we're generally talking about fairly modest changes here, which right. can have an outsized benefit for kids. So the American Academy of Pediatrics and the CDC in 2014, 2015, respectively, recommended that no school start before 8:30 in the morning. And
any age, all age groups?
Basically all age groups. Oh. If it were up to me and I was designing a school district from scratch, I'd probably have the elementary school start at 7:30 or 8 in the morning, middle school at 8:30, and high school at 9. That's not the world we live in, because people get used to a certain schedule. But, you know, in our town, we've been talking about this. People act like, you know, we're making this change and it's going to essentially ruin their children's lives.
You don't think the big kids will stay up later, seeing they can sleep more?
Well, no. And that's a valid question. When they looked at this, though, and the first district to do this was Minneapolis. They did this in, I think, 1997. And they moved high school from 7:30 to like 8:15 or 8:30. I don't remember which. And they actually found that the kids went to bed a little bit earlier. And everybody was a little bit puzzled by this. And as best they could tell, these kids were more efficient at getting their homework done. So they were just able to go to bed a little bit earlier. You know, a lot of it is about kind of syncing up your biological clock with your schedule, right? So a teenager getting on the bus at 6:30 in the morning is like maybe you or me getting up at 4:30 in the morning. Like, we can do it, but it doesn't feel very good. Yeah. Or to use the analogy of jet lag, if you live in the West Coast and you go an hour or two east, you're going to have a little bit of difficulty getting out of bed in the morning. And the teenagers tend to have difficulty adjusting for a couple of reasons. First of all, on the weekends, they go back to their biological schedule. And second, and this is where technology comes into it, having that light exposure in the evening kind of perpetuates this later preference for later sleep times. It's what we call a chronotype, the technical term.
Yeah, that was my next question, is this movement that I'm reading a lot about as blue light, the blue light devil. That our computer screens and TV screens emit the same blue spectrum of light that the sun does, that triggers the cortisol that causes us to wake up. And so by therefore watching television or being on a computer screen late at night, you're kind of telling your body to continue to release this cortisol to stay awake. And then it's not until you disengage from that that the melatonin starts to come in, and that helps you kind of ease into falling asleep. Is that right?
Well, for the sleep thing, I think of the melatonin as being the most important thing. And when people think of melatonin, they think of over-the-counter sleep remedy, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, natural.
And we use it a lot in clinic. I mean, the weird thing about melatonin is it's a hormone, right? So it's not like you're like, oh man, you know, I'm going to go to the store and get Jamie some testosterone so it can bulk up a little bit, right? Like, you can't, you know, but you know, and it's also, it's regulated by the FDA as a food supplement, not a medication. So you're giving your kid a milligram of melatonin, they could be getting 0.2 milligrams of melatonin, they could be getting 4 milligrams of melatonin. Nobody's
serious
really sure.
Medicine does not come in gummy bear form.
Totally. In the EU or in Australia, you need a prescription for it, and then you know what you're getting. But anyway, melatonin is the hormone of darkness. So the signal, we talked about the body clock thing. The end of the wakefulness signal, when that ends, that's when melatonin secretion starts going up. And we know that blue-white light exposure suppresses melatonin secretion. So light exposure in the evening suppresses melatonin secretion and moves you towards a later sleep period. Just like light exposure in the morning actually over time will move it earlier. And for a lot of my teenage patients, I actually recommend those light up alarm clocks. I have one and I love that thing. And it simulates a sunrise, and it has a sound too, but it gets brighter and brighter in the half hour before you have to wake up. And that actually can help people keep on an earlier schedule.
Is it worth getting the what they're calling those computer glasses that block the blue light from hitting your eyes from a computer screen or a TV screen?
Justin, we know no self-respecting teenager is going to wear those.
Right. but a lot of overprotective parents will buy them.
there's some software you can use. I'm less familiar on Android, but you know, on iPhone and iPads, they've got the Night Shift They have that on the Mac computers too, but I prefer some free software called Flux. And if you have, you know, for kids that have to work on their computer, and many of them do, that's how they do their homework now. If you go to the website, justgetflux.com, it's free software. And what it does is it makes the light from your computer more yellow in the evening after sunset, and then changes back to the regular color temperature in the morning. It's free. And they're actually doing some research up in Boston now showing that it does help people have a healthier sleep period. So I recommend that to all my patients.
Let's take a quick break, and then I want to come back and I want to get into with you, Dr. Canapari, the what Dr. J did for me with pacifiers, where it was a thing where it's like he told me that after 3 months, babies don't really need the pacifier to satiate themselves. Right. You could take it away and it's actually easier than waiting till they're almost a year or whatever. Right. The longer they have it, the worse off. And I found this information out when my youngest son was about two. And so I was like, damn it. But it's good to know. I think you're about to do this for my hate and disdain and most people, especially with younger children, for daylight savings time. I personally believe that at this point in our history, that daylight savings time only exists to fuck up people with young children's lives twice a year. That's
and three. My colon.
Yeah. All right, we'll talk about
that. Weird, isn't it?
Yeah. After these messages.
Go to sleep, you little babe. Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Your mama's gone away and your daddy's gonna stay. Don't leave nobody but the babe.
So twice a year, we just went through it here. We sprung ahead, I guess. I don't know if sprung is the right word or whatever, but you jump ahead and instantly you, as a parent, I feel like you have some time over the weekend to try to get your kid ready to get up and get to school. And you have to suffer through about a week to a week and a half of like, come on, we got to go. Come on, we got to go. More so than normal. All because of daylight savings time. And I noticed, thanks to Dr. J, that Dr. Craig has a kind of a process. It seems like a recipe book almost on his website at drcraigcanapari.com. The link for that is in the description of this episode. There's even a YouTube video about this. But walk us through this. So what does daylight savings do to sleep cycles, and what can we as parents do for our kids?
Yeah, well, you know what? I'll say this is a really confusing topic, and every year I have to kind of look at this again and get the terms right. So right now, we have sprung ahead. We are in daylight saving time, which, again, it's kind of controversial whether, even when it started, if it was going to benefit agriculture. I know Florida now is looking at having a big, quote-unquote, daylight saving time year-round because you get more light in the evenings. The problem with this is essentially it's like incurring jet lag twice a year, really without a clear benefit to most of us. So in general, springing ahead is going to be harder if you have problems getting out of bed in the morning, which is more likely to be your teenager or you or me, for example, if you're not a morning person. And falling back is going to be harder if your kid gets up really early in the morning. Because if your kid gets up at 5:30 and you fall back, all of a sudden they're getting up at 4:30 in the morning. Again, their biological schedule takes time to catch up. What we've just gone through is springing ahead. So, you know, you take a teenager who is having problems getting up at 6:30 in the morning, then all of a sudden, when they start school after daylight saving times restarts, they have to get up at what their body thinks is 5:30 in the morning. Hmm. And the weird thing about this, I think, you know, Dr. J was, you know, regaling us with tales of his colon, yes, is that this seems to cause more disruption than you would expect, right? Like, you know, we know that people are more likely to get car accidents after daylight saving times. Time begins or ends.
Really?
It seems to probably just because they're a little bit sleep deprived. It can affect other things that are governed by the body clock, like your bowels, etc. I mean, I swear to God, the Monday after this, my 10-year-old was pooping at 4:30 in the morning, and I'm like, "What are you doing?"
It's like, join the club, buddy.
It's like not even his You know, you haven't even had an espresso or a cigarette yet, you know? So
all I know is if I have ever had to cross time zones during the change to daylight savings time, I'd probably have to be hospitalized.
Well, I'm curious about Jay's experience with this, too, because the thing I've noticed in my practice is kids who are really prone to significant sleep problems, like kids with autism, they can have parents have told me their kids can have issues for a couple of weeks after this. And it's not just when they're falling asleep or when they wake up. They may have more problems with waking up in the middle of the night. I think of it, it's almost like dropping a pebble in a pond. And, you know, our bodies are these really fine-tuned machines. We get used to a certain schedule of when we eat, when we're exposed to light, when we go to bed, when we get up. And kids that are kind of teetering on the edge of, you know, being comfortable in their skins, and that's what really autistic kids are like, they can have a lot of disruption around them. So, you know, usually what I recommend with spring ahead, and of course it just happened, is you can adjust your schedule a little bit in advance if you think your kid's going to have problems, moving it a little bit earlier in advance. The fact is, it's always easier to move later than earlier. Like, we've all experienced this. You can stay up an hour later without a lot of difficulty, but if you have to go to sleep 20 minutes earlier, you may have some difficulty. So a good rule of thumb, if you're trying to shift someone's schedule, you could go a couple hours a day. Sometimes we do this for kids with body clock disorders. But if you have to go earlier, you can really go 15 minutes a day, and that's about it.
Yeah.
And you try and shift things up by just 15 minutes a day? And how far out again do you do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it really depends. There are some kids where you're like, it's going to be a little bit difficult for my teenager to get up early. I usually just say, you know, get up a little bit earlier the weekend of, maybe go to bed a little bit earlier. But the fact is, we know, as we talk about with teenagers, we could tell them to go to bed whenever. We could put them to bed at 6 o'clock at night. They're not going to fall asleep that much earlier. So I think more than anything else, it's about adjusting the wake time in the morning. And the recipe on my website are really for kids who are probably even struggling a little bit more. And you know, if your child is one of these kids who is literally failing his first period class because he can't get out of school, in that situation, you may want to be more deliberate about a schedule of really moving everything earlier. And that's not going to be true of most. That's not going to be true of most kids. But if your child has that sort of issue, you're going to know.
So, obviously go to drcraigcanapari.com. The link is in the description of this episode, and you can use it as a resource. He's got tons of blog entries and stuff there, articles that are available for you to peruse. But you can find this one that'll walk you through a process to adjust for daylight savings time. The other question I had is, and I'm sure it's something that you get hit with a lot, because I feel like it is right up there on the highest need of parents, and that is those with new children, new babies. How the fuck do I get to sleep all the way through the night? And anytime you hear somebody else's baby, like especially a first child, you know what I mean? Like, you got a couple kids and they're just coming. Your youngest one has just turned two. And so you're coming into the light and you get to see some asshole who's wearing some kind of like a sarong that they wrap their baby around themselves. And then they're saying, oh, she sleeps like 13 to 14 hours at night. This is just so refreshing. And you just want to punch them right in their Adam's apple.
Oh, yeah. Those people don't come to see me in clinic usually.
Well, that's what I mean, is that, and I think everybody is constantly looking. I remember talking to the nurses when both my sons were delivered, and they have those wooden little carriers and the plastic Tupperware bins that they put the babies in with the blankets, right? And that people would come back after being discharged, and they would say, I will give you $1,200 for this little carrier thing, because that's the only thing that they would sleep in. And these new parents wouldn't understand that the reason that the kid was sleeping while you're in the hospital is because being born is kind of exhausting, even for the person doing it. And it's more coincidental than it is that he's like, man, I just really, that first bed I got, super comfortable, by the way.
I'll tell you, a lot of what I write, and I'm actually writing a book now for parents of older kids who are, struggle with these issues, but it's the worst sleep deprivation is right out of the gate. And I mean, you know, because babies come out, they're super disorganized in the first couple months of life. And I think is what you point out is that parents are desperate for any solution, and a lot of it just comes down to their kids' temperament. Like you know, I can tell you, I was super lucky with my first son. We took him home to the hospital, and the first night he slept till like 5 a.m. I woke up and I thought he was dead.
Yeah.
I ran into his room and I was like, holy shit, he just died. And he was fine. You know, and then, you know, it wasn't quite so easy with my second boy. And he went through a period which was, he was getting up at 4:30 a.m. And it was just, terrible. Cause I, you know, I'm not a morning person, and neither is my wife. And, you know, Teddy was just pretty psyched to, get up before dawn and hang out. And it's, it really takes its toll. I mean, both on your functioning as a parent and your functioning as a member of society who has to, say, drive places safely and function as a job. It's very difficult.
Well, and I read, so what I did was we read the Baby Wise book. And what I really liked about the Baby Wise technique was, is that it seemed to kind of combine what they call cue-based feeding and routine. Like, so you, at the time, I guess this book was written, there was two schools of thought. Either when the baby is upset, you feed the baby and then that cycles their routine, or it is strictly by a clock. And what they did was they said, you know, the first 2 or 3 weeks, you establish this pattern. When the baby wakes up, you feed the baby. Then you kind of let the baby play. You play with the baby. And then the baby gets tired. You put the baby to sleep. And they even encourage you to lay the baby down in the crib while they're still partially awake. Like, you'll get to know the cues so that they learn to teach themselves to kind of fall asleep on their own. An asshole, and with our first son, I was so excited to be a dad that I loved having him fall asleep on my chest and watching Nip Tuck. That's what I did. So it got to the point where then when my wife was home with him and I would go out on the road, she couldn't put him down. And I was like, whoops. And so we tried the, you know, you heard about the stereotypical training method where you go in there and you let him cry for 5 minutes and then you go and you pick him up and then you try to calm him down and then you set him in and then you let him cry for 10 minutes. Well, for me personally, like, that made it worse. It got to the point where my son could feel the threshold of his bedroom. I'm not making this up. Like, it was a disturbance in the force. Like, all of a sudden, his bedroom had a magnetic field that the inner ear hairs that he had could sense. And as soon as I crossed that threshold, he would start to furrow his brow. And then I did this. I stepped back, and he would calm down. I stepped towards the door, and he'd go, and I'd step back, and he would calm down. It was the weirdest experience I ever had as a parent. So is there anything that I could do other than once I've screwed that up, or is Baby Wise in the right mode of thinking with routine and stuff?
Well, you know,
how old are we talking here? Because I think it's different with different ages.
Sure.
So, with the little ones, I mean, the first 2 weeks of life, they sleep for 20 hours a day, period. And the 4 hours they're up, they're eating and shitting. That's all that they do the first 2 weeks. They hit a little growth spurt at 3 weeks. They get a little more awake time. But most of it in the first couple of weeks is just related to, you know, the normal need to feed every 2 to 4 hours. But with older kids, I mean, it's completely different. At 6 months, I think, you know, at a 6-month-old, going in every 5 minutes, as you said, Justin, just fuels the fire. It just adds more gas. And, you know,
then you
got to start all over again. The different ages, I tell parents at the prenatal visit before they've even had the baby, I tell them, listen, the first 12 months of having this kid at home, you're going to lose out on 750 hours of sleep, and you won't lose out on this much again until they're teenagers. So, you know, I give them that warning right at the beginning. So at least it's not unexpected, you know?
You know, I think that it's funny. Like, you know, as someone who's writing a parenting book now, first of all, most parenting books can be boiled down to a pamphlet. I mean, let's be real.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, there's a certain amount of repetition that has to go in so people get the message and you give them examples, et cetera. And some of it comes down to philosophy. And, you know, especially the stuff in the first 3 or 4 months, I feel like it's almost more about training parents to a routine than a child. Like, you know, everybody's had their, who's had their first kid, you know, you have no idea what to do. And even like, I was a pediatric resident in a fellow in sleep medicine. And then still you get your kid home and they do all sorts of weird stuff. And you're like, is this normal? Is this okay? I mean, like, you know, my kids' pediatricians were like people I did residency with. And like, my wife would step out of the room and like, my kid have this like bump on his rib, which like was a totally normal thing. And I'm like, can you please just tell me that's not cancer? I'm like, I know it's not, but I need you to just say those words.
Well, and it makes it worse because you even know more. Like, you know more what to look at, so it's easier for you to fall down a rabbit hole of fear. I get it. Yeah.
I find it's harder to deal with people who know less. That's my day.
Well, you know, you got, like, Baby Wise is sort of more popular with people who like more structure, right? And my parenting philosophy kind of falls in that camp a little bit as well. I mean, I believe, and Jay would know this better than me, Baby Wise had some controversy because as the kids get older, it can be very rigid about feeding. And I think that they had some sort of controversy about parents following it to the letter and underfeeding their kids. And of course, like, this is common sense, right? Like, you know, if there's a discrepancy between what the book says and what you think your kids need, you know, try something else or talk to your pediatrician.
One size does not fit all either. You know, it's not a concert t-shirt.
The thing that I found is that, you know, and this is something that's really challenging the era of social media, is the idea that, you know, parent shaming is, like, much more of a problem than it used to be, especially sort of, you know, mom shaming about different practices. Like, one mom, you know, as you said, one mom may be really lucky and their kid sleeps great, and the other may struggle and just feel bad about herself, or dads may feel bad about themselves. And really, parents, we only have an illusion of control, right? You can stick your toddler in the car seat, but you are physically controlling that child. You can't stick your teenager on the school bus if they don't want to go. So you can shape their behavior. This is true in the sleep domain as well, by looking at the way that you sort of set up a good night of sleep, looking at the way that you respond. But really, it's more about managing your own behavior.
Right.
That's a good point.
And kids' behaviors only change and improve if the parents change the way they respond to the behavior.
Yeah. You guys familiar with the idea of that, the habit loop?
No, I'm not.
No.
So, you know, the book I'm writing is about how, you know, and again, the idea of habits and sleep is not new. I mean, it's in the title of Mark Weisler's book. This guy, Charles Duhigg, wrote this great great book a couple of years ago, The Power of Habit. And it's essentially helped me to see the real value of the harnessing habits to even an older kid's help them sleep better. So there's three parts to a habit. There's the cue, which is, which is the thing that triggers a behavior. There's the behavior itself. And then there's the consequence of it. So if you or I want to change our behavior, like, you know, we leave the cues alone and the consequences alone, and we try to change the thing in between. So Dewey gives this great example. He was gaining weight because every day it would be 3 o'clock. He'd go to the cafeteria, eat a cookie, and then like hang out and talk to his friends and, you know, go back to his desk. So he figured out that he hit a certain time, he'd feel a little hungry, and then he'd eat this cookie. That was the behavior. And then, but he'd also have the social time of getting up from his desk, walking over and talking to someone. So he changed that for, like, you know, not having a snack and just walking over to someone's desk. When you're changing your kid's behavior, you can't change their behavior. You can change your cue and the way you respond to it. So, you know, in the project I'm working on, it's the first part is, like, really kind of turbocharging the kid's bedtime. Because Jay knows that if people come in with bad sleep problems, often it's pretty chaotic what's happening at bedtime. They may either have different times every night. They may not have picked the right time to put their child to bed. They can have these bedtimes which are nuts. Like, the kid is, like, running upstairs, changing, going out in the yard, hitting their brother with a stick, coming in and watching a show and playing a video game. And it's just chaos. And really, you can get 80% of the benefit of better sleep for your kid just by being really – have a really strict routine for bedtime in terms of timing, in terms of how you do it. Doing that consistently almost every night is going to get you a lot of the way there.
Right.
Then when we think about sleep training, that's really about consequences. It's about what you do if your child doesn't do what you want them to do. In the hierarchy of consequences, positive consequences are the best, right? Rewarding your kid. And, like, you know, really a reward for a kid is attention from you. It's not like buying them something. you know when you're doing something and your kid's just annoying you,
yep.
like you're trying to talk on the phone for work and then you yell at them. Well, that's still attention. Like yep. they want your attention.
My wife falls and for this every night.
Yeah, totally. And you know, any attention from you is a powerful reinforcing thing. Then there's ignoring them, and that's extinction. That's quote unquote cry it out, or either with checking, which is what you're describing, going in and out. And by the way, checking is for parents; it's not for kids.
Right.
In my experience, it almost always makes things worse.
Really?
Transiently.
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that.
I don't know what your experience is. When I checked on my kid, my older son, he'd calm down for a second, and I leave the room. He would scream,
and it would just start the whole cycle all over again.
Well, yeah. And I know we got to take a break, so I don't want to interrupt you, Doc. But see, my wife, even though they're 9 and 6, she does this. So the kids go to bed at 8. We go to bed a little after 10 or 10:30, and she goes in there. And this whole all this research, and I hope I'm not raising my kids to be pussies, but the idea of this circadian rhythm. I go, well, what if they're in a deep sleep and the noise you make or the little bit of light that comes into the room when you walk in there just to make sure they're still covered up is interrupting their sleep pattern, and then partially why they're grumpy a little bit the next day when you don't need to really do that, right? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, no, I would say that, unless your child is, getting up and asking for, a Reese's peanut butter cup, it's probably okay to look in on them.
Okay.
Your deepest period of sleep is in those 2 or 3 hours after you fall asleep. So that's the time if your kid falls asleep in the car, you can pick them up and bring them into the house. You can do all sorts of stuff. The problem is usually after that. And, again, if you've ever had a sleeping problem with your kid, once you get them to fall asleep, then you have a couple of hours where you can chill and do the laundry and watch TV, and then you get into bed, and that's when they wake up, right? So that interval usually, we would call it a code red if we checked on our kid and they'd wake up, when they were younger, when you're going in, and you're like, oh, holy shit, he's waking up. We have to get out of the room.
go, run.
Go.
Abort.
Yeah, but I think it's probably okay. I mean, it's being a parent, right? You know, the idea that you have to magically keep your kids alive by, checking on them periodically.
Let's take another quick break because I know Dr. Craig's got a heart out here, and I got a couple more questions that will hit you in just a few minutes. So we'll be right back after this. The thing that I wanted to also talk to you about, Dr. Canapari, is that my mom was a respiratory therapist before she retired, and she had one piece of advice for my dad. It's interesting. Both of them were centered around sleep. I'm just now realizing. My dad's piece of advice was don't do the whole solidarity thing when the kid wakes up. He said, one of you should always be well rested. I recommend it to you since she's got to get up and feed him because there will be a moment where she will hit a wall and need you to tap her out. And you don't want to be just as tired as she is when that happens. And it was great advice. The second advice was my mom was very anti co-sleeping because she, as a respiratory therapist, had so many situations where babies would be brought into the ER, oftentimes, unfortunately, too late. Because mom or dad had, in a fit of exhaustion, had rolled over on the baby and suffocated it, and so she said, "Just please don't do that." And it's funny, I don't judge people. I don't like to tell people what to do, but I would be lying if every time somebody talked about, "Oh, they're struggling because they co-sleep," and they like the fact that the baby can just kind of crawl over and feed in the middle of the night without disrupting anything. In your opinion, or am I accidentally sending you down a path of landmines here with this question?
No. Sure. And the first advice, the idea of, I think that, taking shifts is super important for parents. And I've got to tell you, man, and this is a dad podcast. You probably have a lot of dads that listen.
Yes.
Let's be real here.
We have moms.
A lot of the time it's the mom doing the heavy lifting.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the sleep domain. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen moms who are exhausted and they're like, yeah, my husband travels a lot for work, or we can't deal with it when the kid cries. And I'm like, honestly, all you need to do is say, I'm going out of town for three nights with my friends. And I guarantee you that shit is going to be dealt with when the mom gets home. Yeah. Because, like, first of all, the kid's going to be like, well, it's not mom. Forget it. I'm just going to sleep.
Yep.
And second of all, the dad's going to find and be like, wow, this is actually really difficult. So I am going to be more involved in fixing this.
You're correct. Correct.
Yeah. And it really, I've had so many families where I'm like, just go away. Just don't ask dad. Tell dad and it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's totally going to be okay. So the co-sleeping thing is a little bit more complicated. And I think it's like, I mean, you know, Jay is probably nodding his
head. It's a good way for everyone not to get a good night of sleep. That's what it is.
I personally am not a huge fan of it, and I don't recommend it to people. And it's partly because of my professional bias, meaning that the people who come to me where kids are sleeping poorly and they're co-sleeping, the co-sleeping is a factor, right? But you don't come in the sleep clinic if the co-sleeping is going awesome and it's amazing and you love it.
That's right. So you don't hear the success stories because you're always dealing with people that are struggling, right?
I don't. And look, there is some danger. And I'm kind of a little bit of an absolutist in terms of safety here, because I'm like, we're not talking about like the danger of your kid getting a skinned knee. We're talking about the danger of suffocating your baby. So that's like, you know, it's sort of like, well, how important is it that we on-demand nurse 20 times a night? You know what I mean?
It's a risk versus reward, right? It's a risk versus reward.
That being said, there are many cultures in the world where people co-sleep with their kids and don't have infant mortality like we do in the U.S. And like, I've had arguments with people about this on Twitter, and some of the people who are more supportive of it is like, look, people are going to do this anyway, and you have to tell them how to do it safely. And I hear that. So what safe co-sleeping looks like in the first year of life, specifically the first 6 months, is essentially sleeping on a mattress on the floor with no pillows or blankets and no bed partners. The biggest risk for suffocation is actually if parents fall asleep on the couch with their kid in an easy chair or something like that. Jay, feel free to chime in too. Like, you know, that's what I'm thinking. If you're going to have to do it, that's what you really have to do.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think that, you know, older kids, you know, it's more of a personal choice. But again, like, I think my rule of thumb is this, is that once you get the safety issue out of the equation, is that I think it's important that everybody in the house get a good night of sleep, not just Junior, but mom and dad as well.
Like
that mom and dad's health and mental health and safety and well-being is very important.
You have to take care of yourself in order to take care of the kid, right?
Oh, totally. And like the thing is that's going to make you a shit parent is if you're exhausted all the time and you're blaming them for it.
Right.
And I think that the other weird thing is, you know, I mean, honestly, you know, Dr. Sears, like I was just, for my book, I was rereading the baby book. And, you know, he and his wife, who co-wrote this book, there is some wisdom there, and it's not all totally off base. I mean, some of it's weird when he's like, well, you know, totally cool if you have sex next to your baby and like, you know, they're not going to notice.
Job.
I'm like, yeah, I'm like that. I'm like, that's pretty, you know, I'm like, that may be the case, but I don't really.
If it was good enough for medieval times, why are you so uptight? Why can't it be done in 2018?
No, totally.
How are they going to learn, Doc? How are they going to learn?
Yeah. No, I know, but you know, it's not. I don't find it really hot myself. But you know, maybe some people are into that.
Yeah.
I can't do it in front of the dog, for Christ's sake.
but I do really think that I don't know. You know, if you apply the litmus test, is everyone sleeping great, feeling great in the morning? Fine. Do whatever you want. That's fine. But if you think it might be a problem, you know, I think maybe work on transitioning your kid. And the other thing is that, for better or for worse, in Western society, independent sleep is like it's one of the metrics of maturity we look at.
Yeah.
And I do think that and Dr. Sears would disagree with me on this, is that like there's nothing wrong with spending some time alone and learning to be comfortable alone and feeling safe by yourself.
Right.
It goes to the husband and the wife too.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I think it's really healthy, and I really know, and I know Jay. I learned this from Jay too. You know, people come to you in your office and they're vulnerable. I really don't I really try not to judge people or bring my own opinions to things. But if they're asking me for my opinion, I'll give it. And I say that most families should, you know, should work towards independent sleep. And the other thing that just came out from the American Academy of Pediatrics when they updated the SIDS guideline fairly recently was the idea that you should room share but not bed share in the first year of life. This is, I think it's pretty problematic for a couple of reasons. First of all, and there's actually a great article in the New York Times, I can send you the link, showing that the evidence for this, that the idea that it prevents SID is SIDS, because there's a school of thought that if you're in the same room, the baby's heart rate, breathing will synchronize to you. I think the evidence for this is very weak, and none of it was new. I think it was more kind of political that they added it in for whatever reason. And there is some pretty clear evidence in this trial called the Insight Trial that parents who room shared with their kids, the kids didn't sleep as well, the parents didn't sleep as well, and there was actually a higher rate of unsafe sleep practices. And that means bringing your kid, falling asleep with your kid on the couch, et cetera. Wow. So I think it's one of those things where it's kind of unintended consequences. I mean, I can tell you, we had a co-sleeper in our room, you know, one of those little tiny bassinets, basically.
Yeah, that's
and,
what we did.
And we found pretty quickly that our son slept better when he was in his own room, and that we slept better too, and that it didn't impede nursing. And that was our own experience. There may be other families where their kids want to nurse a lot more at night, and having the kid there is very helpful. But there really are safe and common sense ways to help people successfully breastfeed, but also enable parents to sleep as well.
But I think it goes back to what you were saying before, is that if you follow the letter of a book per se or anything, that there's then that it's taking it too far to the extreme. And I think it's important for people listening to this who feel like the baby has to be there, but there's a voice in their head. I get a lot of people who would lit right into the show because I bitch about being a parent so much and I don't make it puppies, kittens, and rainbows, that they felt like they were the only ones who felt this way. And so if you're sitting there and you're of the mindset that it's like, I think it's bullshit that my kid has to sleep in a bassinet and I think it's better for them to go in the crib, and you and your spouse agree, then go do it. It's, if that's what you think, or try it out and see how it goes. If you think it'll help you sleep better. And what the doctors are saying is that if you get better sleep and are more rested, it's going to be, make you more of an alert and more of an attentive parent than the kid sleeping there, which is what you would think you're doing, is being a better parent by being closer to your kid. But what really matters is the interactions you have when the kid's awake, not when they're asleep. Right.
Yeah. And I think it's just, I mean, you guys are, Jay, we all kind of grew up around the same time, like the 70s, the 80s. And like the idea that the parent has to be the custodian of their child's happiness and wellness at every moment, it's frankly kind of exhausting. And I don't think it's good for the kids either. I had so much freedom as a kid, and my mom by 70 standards was pretty tightly wrapped, but like, you know, she'd be like, oh, I'll see you in like 3 hours.
Yeah.
Go play in, by the pond. You know what I mean?
And you grew up to be a doctor who works at Yale. So everything's fine.
Brown.
Yeah. Well, and I just finished reading this book called Achtung Baby, and the author Sarah Zasky is going to be on the show. And the German philosophy on this very matter is very different. They are very much about getting the kid into a school because they feel like getting the kid to interact with other kids is way more important than personal contact with their parent. Like for the first year, they're like, sure, year and a half, like you could stay home with the kid. But even when that's happening, you take the kid to a playground and you stay away from them. You let them go play with other kids that are their age. And then they're even in their preschools, they have moments during the school year where they take all of the toys away because they think it's important for the kids to be bored. It helps them create an imagination and creativity. I find it wildly interesting and can't wait to talk to her. But before I let you go, Doctor, the other thing I wanted to ask you is that if there's any kind of common sleep oriented mistakes that you think people make either as adults or with their kids.
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, and we sort of touched on it. You know, self-care is super important for successful parenting, and people shouldn't feel guilty about doing things. In my domain, that means helping their kids sleep better so they sleep better. I don't think that people should feel guilty about it. And I think the other thing is, you know, when we talked about start times, I will say, to get on my high horse a little bit, and this is a sleep issue, but it's a larger issue. I would encourage people to be very judicious about electronic use in their kids and to push it off as long as possible in terms of kids having their own cell phones, for example. Because I think, I don't know, I feel like a lot of it makes kids miserable. You know what I mean? Yeah. I remember my brother in high school, so he's 11 years younger than me, wanted to get a pager. And I was in med school. I'm like, dude, why do you want a pager?
Yeah, like, I know. It's like the devil.
Yeah. And I think that I love technology. And right now my kids are on their iPads, right? Like, I'm not saying no tech, but I'm saying be very thoughtful about it. And like, you know, in the sleep domain, especially, man, do not let your kids keep their cell phones in their rooms at night, because it's going to just crush their sleep.
Or TVs in the room, I've heard, too, because even Dr. Jay and I have talked about studies where they've seen now that infants who had tablets as kind of pacifiers, that now we're getting to see them kind of grow up and they are having a higher rate of depression and anxiety. And they believe it's because as infants, that they're not cultivating the skills of coping with negative experiences or emotions.
No resiliency.
Or even not being stimulated all the time.
Right.
So that's what I would say. But guys, thank you so much for having me on. And, I will, I guess I'll send Jay the links we talked about, Justin, because I'll just text them to you.
Yeah.
And maybe we can catch up to you. My book's going to be called Never Too Late to Sleep Train, and it's coming out spring of 2019.
So then we definitely need to have you on then. Yeah, definitely come on then. In the meantime, you can go to drcraigcanapari.com. The link is in the description of this episode. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at Dr. Canapari, CANAPARI. On Facebook, he is Craig Canapari, MD. The other website you should go to get a part of to be a part of this movement is startschoollater.net. If you want to get involved in the activism to push the start time of school back, and if you want to get the software to reduce the blue light in your kids' computer screens or even their phones, go to justgetflux.com, and you will get a more yellow screen. Again, all of those links are in the description of this episode. Thank you so much to both Dr. J and Dr. Canapari. Canapari, I apologize. On behalf of both docs, this is Justin Worship saying hug your kids, hump your loved ones, and stay frosty, my friends.